Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the Senate Health Social Services meeting to order at 3:32 p.m. on Tuesday, March 12th. We're meeting in room 205 of the Capitol Building. Please remember to silence your cell phones as a courtesy. Committee members present are Senator Geisel, Senator Dunbar, Senator Kaufman, and Senator Tobin. And myself, Senator Wilson, we do have a full complement to conduct business this afternoon. Today, we are also being assisted by a committee aide in training, Ms. Sharon Johnson, from my office. This afternoon, we have three items on the agenda. First, we'll take up SCR 9, mental health substance abuse parity. Then we'll go to SB 27, contraceptive insurance, medical assistance, and SB 240, the school district medical assistance. First, we have SCR 9, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Forrest Dunbar, Senator for District J. Senate concurrent Resolution 9 emphasizes the importance of behavioral health care within our health systems and calls for Alaska to adopt national parity standards. These standards ensure that behavioral health services receive fair and equal access and coverage compared to other medical treatments. By following these guidelines, we can remove barriers that prevent individuals from accessing necessary care and ensure that treatment for behavioral health issues receives equitable treatment, just like treatment for any other health issues. And I know from serving on this committee that all of you care a tremendous deal about behavioral health issues. Rather than go through some of my other remarks, I'll just say that the resolution itself includes discussion of the Paul Wellstone and Pete Domenici Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act of 2008, and what are called non-quantitative treatment limitations, or NQTLs. But rather than go into that myself, Mr. Chair, I'm hoping we can go on to our invited testimony, starting with Mr. John Solomon from the Alaska Behavioral Health Association, who I think can speak with much greater depth and clarity on this issue than I can.
Well, thank you, Senator Dunbar. And you got up there a little too fast before I can introduce your staff, Ariel Wiggins, with us as well.
My chief of staff, Ariel Wiggins.
All right. With that, are there any questions for the bill sponsor at this time before we go to invited testimony? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and go to invited testimony. We'll ask Mr. John Sullivan, the CEO of Alaska Behavioral Health Association, who's here in the room in Juneau with us. Mr. Sullivan, if you can place yourself on the record and please begin your invited testimony.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. My name is John Sullivan. I'm the CEO of the Alaska Behavioral Health Association. We're the member organization that represents roughly about 90 provider organizations across the state. So we're the behavioral health providers that range all the way from your large hospital systems down to your small regional providers, mostly in the behavioral health field. But we also have FQHCs and, as I said, hospital systems as well. Just professionally, I'm a licensed professional counselor. And I came up to Alaska to be a therapist in rural Alaska. So I would fly into villages to do behavioral health care. And then from that, I became a quality assurance supervisor. So it was really my job to train therapists and to ensure quality care and that we're meeting accreditation standards. And then from there, I was a director of behavioral health. So it was really to design programs and make sure that we were stewarding our funds correctly and making sure that there was as much access to behavioral health care in the Northwest Arctic. But then the other part of this that I want to make sure that I get on the record is that personally, I'm a person in long-term recovery. I've been in recovery for about 13 years. About 13 plus years ago, I was using substances like methamphetamine and alcohol. But I was also the ones in your emergency rooms and living on the streets and committing crimes. And now I'm here. I also have bipolar 1 disorder, which is many behavioral health people know that this is a behavioral health diagnosis, but it has also medical implications and genetic issues. So I'm under treatment and will be under treatment for the rest of my life to maintain my stability. And that's just part of being a human being today receiving healthcare. So I say all that because the most important thing to me in the situation that I'm in, both professionally and personally, is access to behavioral health care. And I'm going to talk about parity as in terms of this resolution, because parity is a big word that sometimes gets conflated with other things. And I think in healthcare and in legislative terms, parity can mean a lot of things. But what we're going to talk about is parity legislation or a resolution that ensures that behavioral health treatment has the same access and coverage as medical and surgical treatments. That's what the national legislation standards are. And really, the resolution would direct the state to eliminate barriers and ensure that behavioral health care is subject to the same terms and conditions. So that's without regard to diagnosis or severity or cause. And when I'm talking about barriers, barriers can be a lot of things. A lot of times barriers are outdated regulations that are based on clinical care that was in the past. You know, if you write clinical care into regulations, you're going to end up needing to update them. And I think behavioral health is a newer field in terms of healthcare. And so there's a lot of regulations that are left over from things that we don't clinically do anymore. And then with that, there's a lot of extensive paperwork and management of behavioral health that I would feel sometimes is involved with like the stigma of being a behavioral health provider. It can be, you know, making sure that people are doing care a certain way that you wouldn't necessarily check a medical, a physical health provider the same way. So those are just some examples of barriers. But what I wanted to do is set up a kind of, let's look at parity as it relates to what a client sees. And so if you are having, like, say, a pain in your elbow and you go to a community health center, in one appointment, you can often do your intake, get a brief assessment from the provider, get immediate treatment for those symptoms that you might have, which could be anything for the pain in your elbow. But you would also get ongoing plans for further assessment, maybe referrals to specialists, you know, those things that happen once you do a brief assessment. But you are still getting some sort of treatment for your symptoms. And that happens in your community health centers. But in the system that we have in regulation for behavioral health, community behavioral health centers, so really could be across the street with one of the organizations that I was running. I really did have across the street, you know, providers that would work in both systems. But if you go in this door, you're going to have this experience, which would be you're going to get an intake, you're going to get screening, then you're going to have to set a second appointment for a longer full assessment, which would be a full biopsychosocial assessment, which could be hours. And then your third appointment is going to be an ongoing treatment plan. Now, this is simplified. Obviously, behavioral health and healthcare is complex, but you know, you'd be on the third appointment before you're going to get a treatment plan. And if you have time, you can get into treatment there. But this process takes months, oftentimes. There is a way around this with this crisis, but that means our two speeds are crisis and I can wait many months. And that doesn't really allow for the urgency of people who need behavioral health care that maybe don't want to tip into crisis. So that's what the client sees, but behind the scenes, what we see is a lot of Medicaid enrollments, claims adjudication, documentation standards. These are all fine things, but when they are applied in with a heavier hand than when they're applied to physical health care, we have longer wait times. We have providers that are leaving for private pay. We're having organizations that decide not to take Medicaid because of the different workflows. And we also have an increasing cost of the services because of added administrative time. When you're, you know, when I was budgeting programs and I'm having to add more admin staff versus adding more clinical staff, that's something that was disheartening for me as a director. And then the other thing is that when you build a system based on this, you're really building a system based on audits instead of outcomes. And we really want to have an outcome-based behavioral health system. So what the Behavioral Health Association did is we looked at not only these national standards, but what these parity legislation, which is we're looking for a resolution just to meet these parity standards, is asking the Department of Health, the division, to really look at the different burdens, barriers that you would have compared from healthcare to behavioral health. And so we looked at things like, we just made this kind of what we call a matrix of burden as an initial starting point, where you can see Medicaid enrollments, you're often doing 18 different enrollments based in community behavioral health versus 1 to 2 in your community health centers or your primary care, like pediatricians. But one of the things that I think is important to point out is our documentation standards. We follow the healthcare documentation standards, which is one page of regulations. But on top of that, in community behavioral health, there's an additional 7 pages of documentation standards. And then on top of that, our administrative service manuals are entered into regulation. So you're looking at hundreds of pages of regulatory language. And so this is obviously creates a lot of audit risk for providers. And it's a very complex system. We've even had situations where a typo ends up in a service manual. And then you're looking at clinical care saying, well, do I deliver the proper clinical care or do I deliver to this typo? Because this is in regulation and audits would come back and you'd be held responsible for that as a provider. Now, this isn't an exhaustive list. This is just a starting point as behavioral health. We wouldn't be looking to just base this on behavioral health, obviously. There's things that I think medical providers would say, hey, you know, we do this. You guys don't have to do this. The idea is to build kind of a committee or a way to look at the standards, to look at regulations and just say, hey, are we making sure that behavioral health is accessed as easily as healthcare? So there are times where things would be different. We just want to make sure that they're done in a way that's thoughtful, that we're allowing Alaskans to access behavioral health care. So this is talking about the legislation, the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act, which was passed in 2008, and it was updated in 2022. And there's 37 states, I believe, that follow this, and states have been allowed to pass their own legislation or match parity standards. And so things like, you know, you see that in Wyoming, I think was the latest in 2019 to pass parity legislation. But what we'd be looking at with the resolution is to look at those federal standards and then look at how Alaska Medicaid is setting up our regulations, and then just using those federal standards to help us. And I say us because I say it as the Department of Health, the division in ABHA, some of our partners in primary care and hospital care, to really look at all of this as a group and say, hey, where are the improvements that we can make? What can we help the division with, help the department with? Because as providers, you know, one of the things that people ask with this resolution is like, why now? Why would we do this now? And it's because we believe that the leadership at the department is the right leadership. We're working well with them. The division has vision for how to improve access to care. And so now, if we're working so well together, now would be the time to build these kind of this groundwork, the structure for the next 50 years of behavioral health in Alaska. And I think if we are able to build this structure, things that we'll see is more efficient behavioral health care. You know, you're not going to have as many of these outdated administrative tasks that you have to do. You're also going to see less reliance on emergency rooms because we're not going to be just pushing people to crisis all the time. And then, you know, correctional facilities, I brought up, if I didn't have access to behavioral health care, I wouldn't be sitting in this chair. I'd be sitting in a corrections facility. Hopefully, you know, that's the and then we would have lower wait times to behavioral health. I think that's the thing that our hospital and primary care peers really notice about community behavioral health is they can't get people transferred over to community behavioral health. And that's where you're going to see your higher acuity behavioral health people treated in the community. And so that's really what we're looking at is in the resolution points to that parity legislation. And then we look at those, what we're calling NQTLs, which Dr. Cody Chip will talk about next. He's going to go through the specifics of what the parity legislation, that federal parity legislation does. And these NQTLs, which are non-quantitative treatment limiters, which is a very fancy way of just saying the barriers in regulatory and systems that stop people from getting that easy access to care. So that's what the resolution points to, that, and then it really just reinforces to the department and the division that the legislature supports improving access to behavioral health care by meeting these federal standards and hopefully working together with providers to make sure that we have that groundwork for the future of behavioral health care in Alaska. And with that, I can take any questions. I know that we will. Dr. Cody Chip is online, and he will talk about NQTLs, which can be the really in-the-weeds things that I know everybody is probably wanting to learn about.
Any questions for Mr. Solomon, Senator Tobin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this might not be the right question for you, so please punt if needed. I appreciated the presentation and the information. I'm curious, because in looking at your slide deck and reading the resolution, I noticed that there's not a call for parity when it comes to travel access. And I know that that is part of a 2018 Disability Law Center case. And so just curious if you could expound a little bit about that, or if that is within the purview and I might just be missing where I'm reading.
And through the chair, the Senator Tobin, one of the NQTLs that Dr. Chip will talk about, I don't know if he's going to talk about specifically this one, would be that barrier to care that happens through regional differences. And so somebody who isn't able to access care because where they are, that's a barrier to care that the parity standards would try to eliminate. And so with that, and this is all with the resolution, all of this is a call to work with the department and the division so that we can find these solutions together. It's not laying the solutions on top of the department and the division. It's really ensuring that we're all stepping up together and saying, yes, we believe in parity. And so things like travel, those are part of the NQTLs that we would address.
Follow-up, Senator? Take a brief ideas. Back on the record. Any other further questions for Mr. Solomon? And also for committee, we also have Renee Gerhart, the Director of Division of Healthcare Services from the Department of Health here, as well as Director Tracy Doppling from the Division of Behavioral Health as well. Seeing no questions, we will move on to our next invited testifier, and we will go to the phone lines and talk to Mr. Cody Chip. And Mr. Chip, I know there's a few folks online for public testimony as well. We just want to make sure we get time to go everyone. So if committee needs more into the weeds, we'll just please contact the bill sponsor and see what other additional questions. But we're just trying to, yes, not go into those deep weeds of NQTLs, which
I feel like you've heard me speak before. Sorry. Anyway. Hello, can you hear me okay?
Yes, if you can go ahead and place yourself on the record, you may begin.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. My name is Cody Chip, first name C-O-D-Y, last name C-H-I-P-P. I'm a licensed psychologist here in Alaska. I'm practicing in the mental health field for approximately 20 years, the last 10 years or so as a licensed psychologist. Just kind of a quick recap on what Ms. Solomon shared around the one exciting thing that I think states can do is they, while they cannot weaken federal parity laws, they can absolutely strengthen federal parity laws. So I think that's something to be aware of. And then lots of people might ask, like, well, there's already a federal parity law. Why do we need a separate Alaska one? And one of the main reasons for that is our state of Alaska Medicaid plan is exempt from federal parity requirements because we're a fee-for-service state. And again, recognizing the resolution isn't calling for the legislation explicitly, but rather to partner with the Department of Health and Division of Behavioral Health to work towards the elimination of these non-quantitative treatment limiters or NQTLs. It's a terrible acronym and does not roll off the tongue whatsoever. But I think a few of these are particularly, I'll just highlight a few, particularly around written treatment plans. Treatment plans have been a significant drag on Beaver Health System of Care and creates a lot of inefficiencies. Unlike our medical counterparts who can, you know, their plan of care evolves with every single appointment with a client or patient. In the Beaver Health world, we have to set these out kind of weeks and months in advance. And anytime we make a change in a treatment plan based on kind of the evolving nature of care, we actually have to go back and amend multiple other documents that our medical counterparts, you know, are not beholden to. And so this is like one of these warning signs that the federal legislation points to, some federal resources say, like, hey, if you have written treatment plans, one, that in and of itself might be a warning sign that you're not meeting federal priority requirements. But then you know, you have to have a treatment plan in place before we can get reimbursed for any care. That was also likely a warning sign that you're not meeting federal priority requirements, as well as the submission of treatment plans on a regular basis. Again, is likely a warning sign you're not meeting federal priority requirements, because that's often not required of our medical colleagues. And so that's one example. There's a handful of others, recognizing the time and the need for other people to testify. I won't walk through too many more, but I do appreciate the question around transportation. I think that is another area that I think the department and ABHA and other partners could work towards improving both emergent and non-emergent travel and access for behavioral health and related concerns. So that is something I think I would love to see personally as this resolution, if this resolution carries forward, you know, working with the department through ALPA in resolving some of these disparities when it comes to travel for service, both for emergency and non-emergency services. Again, I want to pause and welcome to any questions at this time.
All right. Thank you for providing your testimony, Mr. Chip. Is there any questions? Seeing none, just want to say thank you again for your testimony. And I believe that is it for invited testifiers. And now we will open it up for public testimony. Anyone in here in the room would like to testify on SCR 9? Seeing none, we will go to the offline folks, or the off-net folks. And we will give 2 minutes for a testimony. If you could just state your name and start with Darcy Nevzeroff.
Yes. Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Wilson and members of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee. For the record, my name is Darcy Nevzeroff, Director of Operations for South Central Foundation's Behavioral Services Division. I'm here to speak in support of Senate Concurrent Resolution 9. SCF is a tribal health organization serving over 70,000 Alaskans in Anchorage, the Mat-Su Valley, and rural locations. SCF is one of the largest behavioral health providers in the state, operating over 20 behavioral health and substance use treatment programs. As a provider of primary care, specialty care, and behavioral health services, we see firsthand the disparity of administrative and clinical documentation burden for behavioral health and substance use providers. These burdens contribute to a long wait list to get into treatment and make it difficult for Alaskans to seek care. Part of the access issue is related to intake, assessment, and treatment plans, which are required for behavioral health providers to bill for services. Assessment and treatment plans alone may take 3 to 8 non-clinical hours, hours that a provider cannot spend providing clinical care. A medical doctor does not have to spend several appointments assessing a new patient with a long-standing diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. Why should care for a person with a long-standing diagnosis of depression or anxiety be treated differently? Behavioral health care is health care, and we're asking for the administrative and clinical documentation requirements to mirror that of other health care providers. We are required to be accredited by a national organization and meet over 2,000 standards to ensure we are providing high-quality services and meeting best practices. Please support this resolution to move towards the goals of the 1115 waiver to increase access to services and quality care being provided to Alaskans. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Darcy. Next, we'll go to Ronto Rani. If you can state your name, and then follow it by Lance Johnson.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ronald Roney, and I serve as the Director of Behavioral Health from the Millick Association in Kotzebue. I'm here today representing Tribal Health to advocate for crucial need for parity in accessing behavioral health care. While Alaska has made significant strides in destigmatizing behavioral health issues and increasing access to care for its residents, one persistent barrier remains. The challenge of providing immediate access to care for those in need. When individuals in our community seek behavioral health services, they are often confronted with cumbersome paperwork and documentation requirements, which can deter them from continuing to pursue care. Our ask is simple. When someone walks through our door seeking help, we want to be able to provide them with the treatment they need without unnecessary delays. This does not mean bypassing necessary screenings and assessments. Rather, it means prioritizing immediate care while addressing documentation needs over time. When I compare this to the experience of taking my children to see a primary care physician for a common cold, the disparity becomes clear. My children do not need to go through a lengthy enrollment process or assessment to receive care. Instead, they are promptly treated based on the doctor's assessment of their symptoms at that moment. I highlight my children in this example because they represent a demographic greatly impacted by the lack of parity in accessing behavioral health care services. The more paperwork and bureaucracy involved, the harder it is to engage parents and caregivers and to ensure timely access to care for our youth. Simplifying the process of getting youth and adults into behavioral health services will help us achieve our goal of providing fast, ethical, and efficient care within our communities. I urge the committee to prioritize implementing parity and accessing behavioral health care services by reducing administrative burdens and streamlining processes. We can ensure that all Alaskans, regardless of their location or circumstances, receive the timely and effective care they deserve. Thank you for your attention to this critical issue.
Thank you for your testimony, Ronti. Next, we have Lance Johnson. Mr. Johnson, if you could place yourself on the record and begin your testimony, and then we'll follow up by Dan Bigley.
Thank you, Chair Wilson. This is Lance Johnson, LanceJohnson. I'm the COO for the Alaska Behavioral Health Association. I was actually put in queue to listen in, but I will just take a moment just to say that I am in support of this, obviously, and I really appreciate everybody's testimony so far here. You know, we've been talking about parity and making it easier for people to get into behavioral health services for 30 plus years in this state, and the time for action is really now. As John said, we have an opportunity because we work very well with the department and with the Division of Behavioral Health to really make some differences here in getting people access to services. You know, we see how they are accessing services now, some of the people who are most in need. That's through our jails. That's through our emergency rooms. That's through crisis centers. And so the time is now to be able to go ahead and allow people to get into services in an easier manner and have immediate access to the treatment that they deserve, just as they do when they go into primary care. So I appreciate the time, even though I was caught off guard, but I really appreciate it. And I appreciate the opportunity for this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we'll go to Dan Bigley.
Chair Wilson and members of the committee. My name is Dan Bigley. I'm the president and CEO of Denali Family Services. I've worked in behavioral health with youth and families for the last 21 years. And I'm in support of SCR9 and the concept of parity, primarily because in the last 21 years, I've not once seen an NQTL provide a benefit to the youth and families that we're serving. Instead, you know, really what I've seen in that time is that the impact of those NQTLs really provide a barrier to accessing care. It places a lot of administrative burden on providers. It's a significant factor in burning out providers and causing them to leave the field for private practice. It really serves as a barrier for folks that are working in private practice to provide behavioral health services. It presents a barrier to them being open to the idea of providing Medicaid services for Medicaid recipients. And really places just this administrative strain on both providers and on youth and families seeking services. The challenge is that when we put things into regulation that are otherwise governed by accreditation standards, by licensure requirements, by training and education, is that it really impacts how providers show up to provide services and provide care. And I guess my point is really that care should not be driven by regulation, but rather by best practices and training and education. And so, just thank you guys for allowing us to be here and appreciate the opportunity to provide comments and look forward to seeing where this goes in the future. I'm primarily looking forward to days where our quality assurance departments can be really focused on the quality of care and on our use of evidence-based practices rather than focused on simply regulatory compliance. So thank you.
Thank you, Dan, for your testimony this afternoon. Seeing no one else online, is there last call? Anyone in the room would like to testify on SCR9? Seeing none, we will go ahead and close public testimony. And if folks would like to submit written comments, they can too to our Senate HESS email address at shss@akleg.gov. We'll close public testimony. And are there any final questions for the bill sponsor? I'm going to ask a quick question to the Director of Behavioral Health, Ms. Tracy Doplin, if you can come to the table. Thank you, Director. My question was, my understanding is the department is already looking at implementing regulations to increase or I guess decrease some of the burdensome paperwork and increase the parity in the medical. Can you speak to a little bit about what the department is currently doing and has plans to?
Yes. For the record, Tracy Dompling, I'm the director for the Division of Behavioral Health. And Mr. Chair, we've been working on reducing administrative burden. I've been in this position since last June. Prior to that time, there was even work kind of heading in that direction, especially under the leadership of the commissioner and deputy commissioner for the Department of Health. We utilized the public health emergency to temporarily suspend service authorizations for estate plan services as well as 1115 services. We went through the 1115 regulation package that just went into effect on February 2nd. That eliminated most service authorizations for outpatient treatment as well as service limits. We had listening sessions with providers as we were getting ready to move forward with a regulations package looking at eliminating service authorizations for outpatient behavioral health services under the state plan. We're hoping that those will be in effect prior to the end of the public health emergency in May. We've had opportunities to work really closely with the Alaska Behavioral Health Association. We've talked about regulations that have been identified by the organization that would help increase parity. We at Behavioral Health, just within the last couple of months, brought another position, had reallocated a position within the division to work within our regulations section. So instead of just having one person who works on regulations, we now have a team of three people that can work on regulations amongst other different tasks. So I feel like we've done a lot of work already. We will certainly be doing a lot of work moving forward. And I think that it's definitely something we can accomplish.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the director? Thank you for that statement. And hopefully we can move forward and accomplish many other great things. With that, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could make a brief remark from here, I'll just say thank you to the folks that testified and to the director, I mean, she just said, I think there are great things happening in the department. I think they're moving in the right direction. And that's why I think it's better to have this kind of resolution where we as a body basically are encouraging them to keep moving that direction rather than trying to do a statutory fix for something that is incredibly complicated regulation. So, again, I applaud the department for the work they're doing, and I hope that we can pass this resolution and work on behalf of the Behavioral Health Association. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Senator Barr. This time, we'll take a brief at ease before moving on to SB 27, contraceptives coverage for the insured medical assist by Senator Tobin. We are back on the record. Before we move on to SB 27, just want to set an amendment deadline for SCR 9 for Monday, March 18th at 5 p.m. It will be amendment deadline. And now we have Senator Tobin here with her staff, Mike Mason, to introduce us our first hearing of Senate Bill 27. And we will turn the floor over to Senator Tobin. And Mr. Mason.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Luki Gail Tobin, and I have the pleasure and the privilege of representing Senate District I here in this body.
Through the chair, my name is Mike Mason. I'm staff to Senator Luki Gail Tobin.
Thank you. And it is my honor to bring forth Senate Bill 27, which is a bill to extend contraceptive coverage for 12 months. And I'm going to talk a little bit about what the bill does, but before I do that, I want to introduce to you why this is so important and why I think it's a critical piece of legislation. There's a 2020 report by the Joint Economic Committee from U.S. Senate, and it talks about why the access to birth control is so critical for women. In that report, it talks about how access to contraception improves economic outcomes for women, and this includes higher education attainment, higher income, better health outcomes, reduction of female poverty, reducing the gender pay gap, and increasing labor force participation. We know that access to birth control is constitutionally protected, as that 1965 Supreme Court decision tells us so. But that doesn't necessarily mean that women have access. It just means that they are able to have a constitutional protection, to have the opportunity to engage in use of birth control. Here in Alaska, we know that many Alaskan communities are without an actual pharmacy. And as we continue to see pharmacy closures across the state, I am worried that women are having a reduction in access to birth control. From my own hometown to travel, you will have to go through many different places to get access to a pharmacy. And we've been seeing as post offices and USPS access is being reduced. We recently received information that we have 75 vacancies in our USPS offices across Alaska, meaning that if you access birth control through mail, you might not get it for 3, 6, maybe 12 weeks. We also have experienced extreme weather across the state. And if there is extreme weather happening that may impede your access to not only the post office, but also to getting access to a pharmacy, then again, you're also in that situation where you may not be able to exercise this constitutional right. It is frustrating to know that women have the opportunity to engage in family planning. That means that they can have some really large-scale increases in reducing child poverty and also increasing the opportunity for their young kids to have less poverty later in life. But with these different barriers that I have described, we are seeing this really be impeded here in the state. One of the things I think is really interesting in that 2020 report is that women who have access to birth control, their children actually have higher education attainment. It's because they're able to engage in family planning. Now, one of the things that I think is great about the United States is that we passed the Affordable Care Act. And we see the year after the Affordable Care Act passed that we saved over $483 million out-of-pocket costs for women accessing birth control. We also know that prevention is critical when it comes to preventing unplanned pregnancies. A 2014 study that is included in that 2020 Joint Economic Committee report shows that preventing unplanned pregnancies saved the U.S. taxpayer $15.2 billion in Medicaid-covered maternity and child-related costs. In addition, there was a $409 million cost savings in Medicaid costs associated with miscarriage. Access to birth control not only saves lives, but it also improves the lives of women, their children, and saves us as taxpayers' dollars. Now, the bill before you, Senate Bill 27, is an essential part of healthcare. This bill does have a companion bill that is in the House, and what it would do is expand insurance coverage for contraception across Alaska. It would cover up to 12 months at one time, and as I have talked about, our impeding access to post offices and to pharmacies, this bill would help ensure that women have continued access. There would be no gaps to their ability to engage in family planning. We know that it's important to accommodate an individual's religious beliefs. That's why the bill before you exempts religious employers that meet specific requirements from having to implement the change as outlined in the legislation. And we also know that this bill would help us ensure that public and private healthcare insurers cover 12 months supply. Now, if it's the will of the committee, we will walk through a sectional analysis, and we also have some invited testifiers that can speak more to the technicalities of why this legislation is so important, and also some of the implications of providing this critical coverage to family planning and contraception use across the state.
Thank you, Senator Tobey. Before we go to questions, let's go ahead and cover the sectional analysis, please, and then we'll go to committee members' questions.
Good afternoon. My name is Mike Mason. I'm staff to Senator Lukey Yeltobin. I'll try to go quick. So Section 1 of this bill adds a new section to Chapter 21. That's the section of state law that governs the insurance coverage in the state of Alaska. The new section is labeled Section 21.42.427. It requires public and private insurers that operate in Alaska to cover prescription contraceptives and then the medical services needed for those products and devices. The new section also requires public and private insurers to cover over-the-counter emergency contraceptives that are obtained without a prescription. The new section also requires insurers to cover the cost of dispensing prescription contraceptives intended to last 12 months. Currently, public and private health insurance plans in Alaska only cover 1 to 3 months of self-administered contraceptives at a time. The new section also prevents an insurer from passing on the cost of compliance to users and from restricting or delaying contraceptive coverage. Additionally, insurers would be prevented from passing on costs to insured persons for services or FDA-approved items that are determined to be medically necessary. And as Senator Tobin noted, the new section would accommodate a person's individual religious beliefs by exempting religious employers that meet specific requirements from implementing the changes called for in SB 27. Section 2 of the bill would change the statute that governs home rule municipalities simply by stipulating that healthcare insurance plans apply to those municipalities. Section 3 of the bill amends Chapter 20, which governs municipal officers and employees. The new section, which is labeled 29.20.420, clarifies that municipal healthcare plans that are self-insured are subject to the requirements of Section 1 of the bill. Section 4 of the bill would change AS 39.30.090. That's the statute that governs the procurement of group insurance. Specifically, the bill clarifies that group health insurance plans covering employees of a participating government unit are subject to the requirements of Section 1 of the bill. Section 5 clarifies that self-insured group medical plans covering active state employees are subject to the requirements of Section 1. Section 6 of the bill would amend AS 47.07.065. That's the statute that governs the payment for prescription drugs for Medicaid. Section 6 adds a new subsection requiring the Department of Health to pay for up to 12 months of prescription contraceptives. The section also applies to medical services that are necessary for the appropriate use of contraceptive products or devices. Section 6 also requires the Department of Health to cover the cost of over-the-counter emergency contraceptives. Section 7 of the bill seeks to add a new section to the uncodified law of the state of Alaska, requiring the Department of Health to submit a plan for federal approval for medical assistance coverage consistent with Section 6 of this bill. Section 8 makes Section 6 conditional upon that federal approval, which is required in Section 7. And then finally, Section 9 of the bill stipulates that Section 6 would take effect on the day after the date that the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services approves the state plan amendment or determines an amendment is not necessary. And that's the quick sectional analysis for Senate Bill 27.
And Mr. Chairman, we understand that there might be some concerns that have been raised by the Division of Insurance, which we are looking forward to potential augmentation or amendments to the legislation to ensure that we clarify any of those outstanding issues.
Thank you. And I'm not sure if this was one issue, but before, I just want to let the committee know that we have Steve Ramos, the Acting Chief Health Administrator for the Divisions of Retirement and Benefits, is on the phone, as well as Director Wing Hires from the Division Director for the Division of Insurance is in the room. And I'll point out to other members if there's any questions on for the bill sponsor. Seeing none, I do have a question on page 2, line 13 on C. How are we going to ensure that healthcare insurance may not offset the cost of the compliance?
Can you please repeat your question?
Yes, it's on page 2 of the bill, line 13 on C, except providing in section D. How are we going to, basically, of this section, a healthcare provider, healthcare insurer may not offset the cost of compliance of this section A. How are we going to make sure that they're not offsetting the cost to their plan holders?
For the record, my name is Luki Tobin, Senator for Senate District I. I think that my question might be best directed to the Division of Insurance, as it would be under their purview to make that requirement and to be able to follow through.
Well, are there any other questions for the bill sponsor before we bring up Director Wanghier? Seeing none, Director Wanghier?
For the record, I'm Lori Wanghier. I'm the director of the Division of Insurance for the state of Alaska. Senator, your question is one that, if I could back up a minute, we have an indeterminate fiscal note on this, and it's for three, I think, relatively small changes. And the reason we put it on is the ACA, for all that's good about the ACA, we also, when the state adopted the essential health benefits or the benchmark plans, we agreed that those were what was going to be presented in the individual market. If we stray outside of those, then the CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, can come back and ask us to defray the cost. There's three provisions of this bill that we think might, and that is one of them, when you're asking an insurer to let go of the co-pays on, if you will, I can read here. We would suggest that C be deleted and be replaced with except for as provided in D, which should alleviate your concerns, sir, of the co-pays that are referenced in C. The other, so for the record, is the over-the-counter, because the ACA does not ask insurers to pay for over-the-counter drugs on the emergency contraceptives. And the final one is also on page 2. Asking for the medical management techniques. It's lines 20 through 29, delete E and replace with a healthcare insurer that applies medical management techniques such as step therapy or prior authorization must provide for a simple and easy to understand exception. I hope those aren't offensive or change the intent of the bill for the sponsor, but those are the three areas that resulted in an indeterminate fiscal note. Again, CMS would have to fine us for it, but there is an off chance that they would do it. Yeah, I don't think it overall changes the intent of the bill that great, but I am going to work with the sponsor to see if she has other ideas of how to get there.
That sounds wonderful. Any other questions for the Director of Insurance? Selena, thank you, Director, for being here and answering the question. Seeing no further questions for our bill sponsor, unless you have a follow-up remark that you, okay. Seeing no further questions, we will go ahead and go to invited testimony. We have two folks here to speak to Senate Bill 27. The first is Dr. Robin Holmes, the clinical provider for medical director for Kachemak Bay, I'm sure that says Family Planning Clinic. Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do want to just state for the record that I do serve on a nonprofit board that does provide operational support to Kachemak Family Planning, and just want to ensure that that conflict of interest is recorded.
Thank you. Dr. Holmes, please put yourself on the record. You may begin.
For the record, my name is Robin Holmes. I'm a family medicine physician. I work in Homer, Alaska. I am here representing myself, not my employers, but you have already mentioned one of my employers is I'm the medical director of Kachemak Bay Family Planning Clinic, which is a freestanding Title X funded family planning clinic in Homer. We provide services up the Kenai Peninsula with pop-up sites all the way to Soldotna and Nikiski. I also am a staff physician practicing primary care for the Ninilchik tribe. Chair Wilson, members of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee, thank you for your time. I'm speaking today in support of Senate Bill 27, which will dramatically improve access to a full range of contraceptive methods by requiring insurance to cover a year's supply of birth control at one time. Senate Bill 27 would also ensure that patients and providers have full control over what contraceptive method is used without arbitrary restrictions on quantity. As a board-certified family medicine physician, I see how access to contraception affects the lives of Alaskans every day. I have the privilege of supporting my patients through the entire lifespan with evidence-based medical care that empowers them to choose when and if to have a family, as well as raising the family they have in the healthiest way possible. Unfortunately, a large part of my job and the advice I give to my clients entails anticipating barriers to accessing their medications, including insurance denials and restrictions on quantity. We know that 1 in 3 women miss birth control or contraception because they couldn't pick up a refill in time. That's 30%+. Barriers to contraceptive imposed by insurance companies make no sense for Alaskans and cause significant economic and physical harm to our populations. I regularly have patients who are in school and can't make it to the pharmacy every month during limited hours that pharmacies are open. I also have lots of patients who are college attendees or commercial Fisher people, and they're unable to fill enough contraception to get through their semester or their time at sea. And most of those patients have to rely on family members who have their own jobs and their own families to get their needed medications in time. Another affected population I see is the population who lives with disabilities, and those insurance plans may deny certain contraceptive access, requiring them to go through a stepwise fashion with contraceptions that they're not able to take due to their disability, either physical or mental. I also see patients who are in the height of their careers, working multiple jobs or taking care of their families who cannot get to a pharmacy to pick up their prescriptions. Whether to use contraception or which contraceptive method to use is a private medical decision that should be made by a patient in consultation with their healthcare provider. And we as medical providers are extensively trained in how to prescribe contraception safely and when quantity restrictions may be warranted for patients. This bill does not supersede a provider's judgment if a short supply is warranted. It only allows for the 12 months of access if a provider prescribes it that way. When insurances get in the way, this causes significant barriers to care. There are both medical and contraceptive uses for these birth control medications, so there are reasons why a pregnancy would be contraindicated from a medical perspective, and there are also reasons to use contraception for medical conditions. A couple of examples of these would be polycystic ovarian syndrome, which is a very painful condition, as well as endometriosis. Both of those, the first line treatment is to use contraceptive doses of hormones, and left untreated, those conditions can lead to infertility as well. And, you know, I think that in these conditions, especially having continuous access to a 12-month supply of birth control is very important, because even missing 1 or 2 days can lead to substantially differences in people's cycles. Outside of Alaska, where there's already significantly less barriers to receiving prescriptions, we've seen how expanding access makes a positive difference. So the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which is the CDC, named birth control as one of the top 10 health achievements in the past century. It's widely credited for contributing to women's societal, educational, and economic gains, as Senator Tobin already referenced. Access to contraception allows people to avoid unintended pregnancy and its possible complications. When women are allowed to obtain a full year of birth control at one time versus a 1 to 3 month supply, which is the standard in Alaska right now, we know that their odds of unintended pregnancy decrease by 30% and the odds of abortion decrease by 46%, which is almost half. Addressing loopholes in insurance's practices via state laws will protect our residents and could reduce both the income-based and geographically-based disparities in unintended pregnancy rates, as well as medically necessary treatments for other conditions. We have proof that bills like this are successful from 26 other states, including Washington, D.C., who have enacted policies such as this one requiring insurances to cover more months of prescription contraceptives. I do want to point out that when we're comparing our state to other states among these 26, it's our responsibility to recognize the racial disparities in almost all health measures, from maternal mortality to suicide rates. Contraception is no exception in these numbers. Alaska Native and American Indian women face financial, cultural, systemic, and geographic burdens to accessing reproductive health, including their contraceptive choices. One of the only one of the 26 states that I mentioned above that have expanded access to contraception that has anywhere near our Native population is New Mexico. And, you know, I think that Alaska needs to be leading the charge in removing barriers to access for our Alaska Native populations. Almost 20% of our population identifies as Alaska Native, and we need to be doing more to be leaders in this space. Expanding access to birth control will put Alaska alongside states across the country that are pursuing common sense and financially sound solutions to barriers their residents face. Birth control is incredibly safe. The patients I care for are very smart and they are aware of their needs. I urge you to support Senate Bill 27 to allow Alaskans meaningful access to contraception. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dr. Holmes. Is there any question? Thank you for coming out this afternoon and providing testimony. Next, we have Dr. Ingrid Johnson, the Associate Professor at UAA, Associate Director of the Alaska Justice Information Center.
Thank you, Chair Wilson, and thank you to the committee. My name is Ingrid Johnson, Dr. Ingrid Johnson, that's I-N-G-R-I-D-J-O-H-N-S-O-N. I live in Anchorage. I am an Associate Professor at the University of Alaska Anchorage. But I'm here representing myself, not my employer. So I'm here as a PhD and not a medical doctor. So I'm a criminologist. Specifically, I study victimization and I study intimate partner violence and sexual violence primarily. Largely, we get very specific in this field. So as we keep narrowing down, I study help seeking, particularly among people who are victims of sexual violence and intimate partner violence. So that means how they seek help for the violence they're experiencing, but also just how they seek care in general, who they talk to about their experiences and things like that. So I come here with that background. I also have a pretty extensive background studying rural-urban dynamics as far as how the criminal justice system operates, but also how victims get services and things like that across the rural-urban spectrum. So I come with a little bit of that. I'm also the principal investigator for the Alaska Victimization Survey. And so I did submit a handout in advance. And so I do have that handout in front of me, and I'll be referring to those bullet points if you all have it in front of you. That might be easiest for this. So several of the statistics in this handout come from the Alaska Victimization Survey, the most recent 2020 AVS is the shorthand for that. And then there's a few that come from a few other sources, and they all have footnotes with the sources at the bottom of the fact sheet. So what I would really like to talk about, this will be relatively short testimony, is just the overlap between access to birth control and intimate partner abuse, and just how restrictions on access to birth control, particularly having to come in to a pharmacy or a medical provider 1 to 3 months to get birth control, the disproportionate impact that would have on people in intimate partner abuse situations, but also how it can increase their risk for violence, and particularly at the bottom of this note, their risk for homicide victimization. So to start with the first bullet, I think this is just a really important thing to know in general, is that almost half of Alaskan women, that's 48.3%, have had partners who control what they can do and where they can go. And so that can make regular trips to a medical provider and or pharmacy difficult. So these controlling behaviors include everything from monitoring who they can associate with, where they can go, what they can wear, what they can eat, whether they have access to money, how they spend money, and it also includes the reproductive control items, which are on the next bullet point. But just in general, that's half of Alaskan women having had a partner who is monitoring them, controlling them, and essentially trying to make decisions about how they live their life. And so when they then have to go to the pharmacy or the provider every month, that can really complicate seeking that care when they're being monitored and controlled in that way. And I would note that that is a generalizable finding, so that is a weighted estimate. That's something I can answer questions about if needed. But basically, that's that 48.3% is a number that we got from our randomized sample of adult Alaskan women, and then we weighted it based on things like age, geographic location in the state, and racial identity, so that we made sure our sample was representative of the state. So this number is meant to be as representative of the adult Alaskan women population as possible. So the second bullet point then is also to point out that almost one in five Alaskan women, so that's 18.8%, have experienced reproductive control in their lifetime, which makes ease of access to contraceptives even more essential to reducing reducing unintended pregnancies. So we have two items in the AVS that we use to measure reproductive control. So one of those is their partner trying to get them pregnant when they did not want to be, or trying to stop them from using birth control. Or the other item is partners refusing to use a condom when they wanted to use one. And so, again, that's one in five women in Alaska having a partner that has done that to them in their lifetime. The third bullet point, this is not a generalizable estimate. So this one comes from a very large sample. It comes from the AVS. So we have the raw data and then we have the weighted data. And so the raw data, this is a sample of about 13,000 women, and it includes all of the women that have ever participated in an AVS. So we did a 2010, a 2015, and a 2020 statewide, and then we also did a series of regional surveys between 2011 and 2015. So this is all 13,000 of those individuals in that sample. So it's not a generalizable estimate, but it comes pretty close. What we see there is that almost 20%, it's 18%, Alaskan women have experienced sexual assault by an intimate partner. So we do have, in separate reports, right, we have the rates of sexual assault for adult Alaskan women that are generalizable, but this one, that's like sexual assault from anybody, not necessarily an intimate partner. But we do know that almost a fifth of adult Alaskan women have been sexually assaulted by an intimate partner, again, emphasizing the need for access to birth control in those abusive relationships. The last bullet point that also has two sub-bullet points for it, these come from non-AVS data sources, but again, I have those cited. Essentially, getting pregnant puts women at an increased risk for violent victimization, particularly women already in abusive relationships. So qualitative research has demonstrated that abusive partners will sometimes intentionally try to get their partners pregnant so that they can't leave the relationship. And we also have quite an extensive body of literature showing that pregnancy increases women's risk of being a victim of homicide. And I think that's particularly important to note in Alaska, where our rate of women killed by men is almost twice the national average. And that concludes my testimony, and I would like to take questions if there are any.
Thank you, Dr. Johnson, for providing that testimony. We do have a question from Senator Dunbar. Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Less a question, more just a comment. Thank you so much for your testimony. You know, I think it's something that a lot of folks don't think about when they see a bill like this, but reading the top of your sort of paper that you gave to us, your research, extended contraceptive coverage as violence prevention, I think makes immediate and intuitive sense to a lot of policymakers that have worked in this space. And so I just want to say thank you again. And you'll probably saw as you were today is a particularly noteworthy day for you to be giving this testimony, right? You probably noticed in the voting today a lot of folks wearing purple or purple ribbons, and today is Ashley Johnson Barr Day. And, you know, it's about violence against children, but it's also about sexual violence and violence against women. And you have, through your testimony, I think, demonstrated this is a concrete step that we could take to reduce the latter two things. And so, again, I just want to say thank you so much for your testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions for Dr. Johnson? Seeing none, at this time, we will go ahead and open public testimony. We will plan 2 minutes for testimony. Is anyone here in the room in Juneau would like to testify on Senate Bill 27? Seeing none, we will go to the phone lines. We have Maureen O'Hanlon, followed by Olivia Lynn.
Hi, my name is Maureen O'Hanlon, and I live in Sitka in Senate District A. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 27. This bill matters to me because I'm someone whose quality of life depends on access to birth control pills. I have endometriosis, which is a very painful condition with no cure. The symptoms and the progression of the disease can be managed with birth control pills, and I've only ever been dispensed 1 or 3 months of birth control at a time. This is obviously inconvenient, especially in Alaska, where so many people work seasonal jobs on boats or live in remote locations. It's a struggle to get an advanced supply of birth control pills when I need them. And you can't overdose on birth control, so there's no sensible reason to restrict my access to them. They don't have street value. It's important to me that my elected officials make choices that support my health and safety, and that's why I'm calling in today to urge you to vote yes on SB 27. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Maureen, for your testimony this afternoon. Next, we'll go to Olivia Lynn, followed by Nancy Skeet Freemiller.
Hello, my name is Olivia Lynn. I'm from Fairbanks, and I'm calling in support of Senate Bill 27. Birth control is a necessity for me to be competitive in my line of work. As a single, childless, union journeyman electrician through the 1547, I'm expected to always be ready to work, and it is always noticed when I'm not performing as well as everyone else. Without birth control, once a month, my performance would die while I was managing my symptoms. And with birth control, I only have to deal with this every 3 months, which gives me the leverage to just schedule the time off to deal with the worst of the symptoms in the comfort of my home, as well as not receive any backlash from management for my poor performance during that time. Everyone in Alaska deserves the chance to become more competitive in their field, to make more money, and raise their standard of living. Consistent access to birth control is essential to making sure everyone has that opportunity. Thank you for hearing my story.
Thank you, Olivia, for your testimony this afternoon. Next, we have Nancy Skeet-Freemiller.
Yes.
Yes, Nancy, if you can place yourself on the record and begin your testimony and plan for 2 minutes.
Yes. My name is Nancy Skeet-Freemiller for the record. I'm retired. I have then worked in the council. I was on the Council of Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I was head of AWAKE. I've been involved in issues that impact women for many, many years. And my piece that I want to supplement what everybody else has said is I want to thank the members of the committee for really, truly addressing this issue and caring about women as a total economic participant in our Alaskan economy, as a participant in our Alaskan society, as trying to create equal access for everybody in our state. It's not an easy job, and I think everything that I heard earlier has a fix for all the issues that were brought up. I think this can be fixed. This is a bill that can really make an impact. It may be small to look at, but it can have a tremendous impact for the future of Alaska, and that's what I wanted to say. Thank you for everybody's work on this issue.
Thank you, Nancy. We'll take
support the bill.
We'll take a brief at ease. We're back on the record, seeing no one else on the phone lines of wanting to give testimony, and seeing no one else here in the room that wish to testify on Senate Bill 27. We will go ahead and close public testimony. And those members of the public that wish like to submit written comment to the committee, they can do so again by our Senate email address for the committee at shss@akleg.gov. We'll close public testimony. Are there any final questions for the bill sponsor? Senator Tobin. I'm sorry, Senator Giesen.
Not really a question, but just thank you to Senator Tobin for offering the bill. I see it was actually offered more than a year ago. Thank you for doing that.
Seeing no further questions, Senator Tobin, do you have closing comments?
No, I just want to thank the committee for hearing this legislation and share a personal story in that while I was in the Peace Corps, I was able to access 12 months of birth control. And at the time, I didn't understand the complications that I personally would experience if I had unintendedly become pregnant. I am very thankful that I was able to participate in that planning for myself. And when later my husband and I decided we would like to get pregnant, I was very thankful that I was near a major medical facility and that I'm here with you today. Birth control can save lives, and I am walking proof of that. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Tobin. We will go ahead and put this bill aside, and we will set an amendment deadline for noon on Tuesday at March 19th. And our last item of business today is Senate Bill 240, which is school district medical assistance. We first took up this bill on February 27th, where we took invited and public testimony. This afternoon, we have a brief reminder that on the bill, Leah Van Kirk, the healthcare policy advisor, is here in the room. Also, to answer questions, we have Don Don, Special Assistance Program Administrator for the Department of Education Early Development. We have Sharon Fischel, School Health and Safety Program Administrator for DEED as well. And Emily Ritchie, the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health, is on the phone. Are there questions for the bill's sponsor for the Department of the Governor? Seeing none, we do have an amendment. We received one amendment, and that was from Senator Geisel. And Senator Geisel has amendment number A2. Committee members should have that amendment. Senator Geisel.
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number 1, otherwise noted as A-2.
I will go ahead and object for conversation. Senator Geisel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The insertion of this amendment states this: allowing minors 16 years of age or older to consent to behavioral health and mental health services, authorizing school personnel to recommend a behavioral health or mental health professional to a child 16 years of age or older. Mr. Chairman, the reason that I am offering this bill is in real life, I'm an advanced nurse practitioner. I'm board certified in family practice, but I can't hold down a real job and still do legislative work. So I volunteer in schools, in school-based clinics. And in that venue, I screen for behavioral health and mental health issues for the students that I am serving. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it is astonishing to me the things that our young people today are having to deal with, and the prevalence of depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation, dietary challenges that our students are dealing with. So I am in the position of recognizing these issues with a student as they share with me. All of this confidential, of course. And then I offer to the student behavioral and mental health services. In the schools that I work in, Title I schools predominantly, we have these clinicians available in the school, on the school premises. A student could access them during the school day, just as they're accessing me for physical health services. And the students often will say, yes, I would like to talk to someone. I need to talk to someone. And so I say, great, I will make that referral, but we cannot actually implement this referral without the consent of your parents. Commonly, the child's face falls with that barrier being presented to them. We do seek consent from the parents or guardians. And most prevalently, there is either no response or the answer is no. So why would this be? Well, you know, a lot of these kids are in families with one parent who's working multiple jobs, or maybe they're in a home with a grandparent that's caring for them because mom and or dad are living in a different state, a different city in Alaska. multiple reasons. But these kids are asking for help, but they're not 18 years of age or older. I would offer, Mr. Chairman, that we need to open access for these kids. And it's not just me saying this. I will tell you that I have been visited in the last 2 years by multiple behavioral health organizations and pediatric groups and groups, nonprofits that serve children and families. And every one of those organizations, everyone has agreed that we need to lower the age of consent so that a 16-year-old would be able to say, yes, I need help, and I am consenting to those services. We have this kind of documentation from the U.S. Surgeon General's advisory document, Protecting Youth Mental Health, talking about increasing access for young people to behavioral health. On December 11th, 2023, just a few months ago, the State of Alaska Epidemiology Department of Health put out a report, Epidemiology of Adverse Childhood Experiences, articulating the prevalence of our adverse childhood experiences in Alaska's children. These adverse experiences, it's astonishing to read the statistics. These are the kids that are saying to me, yes, I need to talk to someone. It says the most common ACE, this is in the epidemiology report, is parental divorce or separation, followed by familial financial hardship. This is so prevalent in our society today, Mr. President and Mr. Chairman. And, you know, these kids, I'm not wanting to portray their parents as bad people. For the most part, these are hardworking parents, but they've got more than one job, or for some reason, the grandparents or other family members have had to take over guardianship of these kids. And sometimes kids have told me, one of the questions that I ask is, how many hours do you sleep at night? And it's interesting to me how many kids say, well, I stay up till 1 a.m., 2 a.m. Well, why do you do that? Well, mom or dad goes out at night and I'm left in charge of the younger kids. I stay up to make sure that they're safe, because we live in a scary neighborhood, and I'm not sure my parent is going to come back. It would break your heart to hear the stories. The ACEs report goes on to talk about the number of people in our correction institutions and the number of ACEs that these folks have, adverse childhood experiences. We talk a lot about stopping supply chain, if you will, of people who are struggling with mental health and behavioral health. I would propose, Mr. Chairman, that by lowering the age to 16, we are offering services sooner to kids that need these behavioral health services. Now, Mr. Chairman, I provided committee members with a document that summarizes what other states do related to the age of consent for behavioral health. And on that document, you will see that 33 states authorize children under the age of 18 to consent to behavioral health services. In fact, one state, two states, Illinois, Maryland, hold it, there's Nevada, age 12. They authorize down to age 12. I'm choosing age 16 just because I am taking it incrementally. A child that is 16 years old certainly knows what they need. Mr. Chairman, in this amendment, I define who a behavioral health professional is, and I have copies of what those statutes are if anyone would like to see them, or you can look them up yourself, of course. And in Section 3 of the amendment, Section 3 of the amendment, I point out that the child who is 16 years of age or older may give consent, but the behavioral health professional or mental health professional may not prescribe medication to a minor receiving services under this paragraph without the consent of the minor's parent or guardian. So, Mr. Chairman, I've spent time talking to parents who have a concern about the use of psychiatric medications in children. I share that concern. I think we are way over-medicating our young people. And that's why I inserted this piece. Behavioral health is not drugs. It's actually therapy. Has been shown to be much more effective. It also goes on to say that in this section, during the course of treatment, the behavioral health professional or mental health professional shall contact the minor's parents and offer to provide services to the family. This is another key piece, Mr. Chairman. We can't treat young people, we can't help young people without also reaching out to the family, because commonly it's family issues that are causing the anxiety, depression, suicidal ideation that these young people are experiencing. So family therapy is critical to treating a young person. And it goes on to say, offer services to the family unless there are clear clinical indications that doing so would be harmful to the minor receiving services, in which case the behavioral health provider or mental health provider shall document these concerns in the counseling record. So, Mr. Chairman, I offer this amendment motivated to increase access to care for our young people. Our school sites are well suited for reaching out to students. That's where they are. These are safe places for most kids. They see this as a safe safe oasis in many cases from the situations in their lives. And this is a great place for them to access behavioral health services. So I offer amendment number one. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Is there further committee questions? I have a question, Senator Giesel, on the payment. Who's responsible for paying for services, the assessment, and we'll start there.
In section four of the amendment, the parent or guardian of a minor is relieved of all financial obligations to the provider of a service under this section. That's what the statement of the amendment says. In a vast majority, in fact, I would venture to say all, but I won't make that conclusive statement, of the young people that I see, they have either private insurance, more commonly, they are Medicaid beneficiaries, which would be billed for these services.
I guess if the minor and guardian are relieved of the financial obligations, are their insurance companies also going to be relieved of those as well, or just the state Medicaid recipients are going to be the only ones to pay for reimbursement of services for medical providers?
Mr. Chairman, that will depend on what kind of insurance the young person has, but they are given the ability to consent for services.
And, you know, just... we've already dealt with this amendment and a similar bill, HB 40, which is in Senate rules. You know, I feel that this bill does a good job of sort of providing educational services and trying to get more increased services in the school, but without the additional parental consent items, or the question about not having, if there's clear clinical indicators about a child that the parent should not be notified, normally we have a little bit more deeper issues involved in those children, or those caretakers are mandated reporters, and those things are reported out to the appropriate authorities, depending on what's maybe going on with that child. I'm just have some concerns that this will just linger and rules, similarly as HB 40 has lingered in rules with this amendment. I'm not sure if the department has a position on this or not, have a position on this. But we'll just leave it at that and just go ahead and take a vote and see what the department will go. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And question for the sponsor, although I think also sort of a statement. This looks a little bit different, I think, than the amendment you offered last year. And not putting words in your mouth, but it seems like this is a little bit more of a, I mean, there were concerns with that original amendment. It seems like there's sort of compromise language in here to try to address some of those concerns. Would you say that's correct?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, that is absolutely correct. This is not the previous amendment, which I made, which was much broader. This is limited to behavioral and mental health services, defines the age. If you look through the definitions of who the healthcare providers are, that's very specific. This is very different. Thank you.
Yes, Sander Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a statement then, not a question. I do support this amendment. I share the chair's concerns about, this is a bill I very much want to see passed. I think it would be a shame if it got hung up in rules. But I don't see this amendment as a reason to do so. I think there should still be strong support for this bill with this amendment in it. So I will vote for the amendment, and I hope I get a chance to vote for the overall bill on the floor. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to the maker of the amendment, in some of the supporting information you provided, show a tabular presentation of the ages in the other states. I was just wondering if anecdotally or in aggregate, if you have any information how they dealt with the financial obligation of a minor incurring an obligation that could end up being borne by the parents or other entity.
Senator Kaufman, through the chair, no, I do not have that information.
And Senator, Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this, again, is just a statement in support. Over the last year, we've seen a 14% increase in our houseless and homeless youth. And one of the things that we know is that educators are often those who identify issues with the young people and in some cases may actually end up suspending or having additional negative recommendations for that young person when really what they need is wraparound services, what they need is family support services. And so I think this amendment really gets to the heart of what many of our young people are experiencing, will help give our educators an opportunity to recommend behavioral health and mental health support for a young person who might just need some additional intervention that they are unable to access because they don't know it's available.
And I believe Ms. Leah Van Kirk is in the room that may be able to speak on the department has a position yet on this amendment.
Thank you, Senator Wilson. For the record, Leah Van Kirk, Healthcare Policy Advisor for the Department of Health. So we are still currently evaluating this amendment, and we are not taking a position.
You feel that this amendment will also will or will not have a note to it? Fiscal note? Cost? Because it looks like that the Senator Giesel statement is, I believe, pretty accurate, that I believe children that are on Medicaid makes up 1.5% the percent of the population of children under the age of 18 in the state, and the state is responsible for paying for the only payer for these services that have been indicated unless they get parental involvement and give up their insurance. Is there a cost?
To the chair, I think we'd have to get back to you and evaluate that information a little bit more closely. Thank you.
And I guess I just have a concern for those ones that aren't in cost and hearing from local healthcare behavioral health providers on how thin their margins are. I don't know many that will continue to do free assessments for children. Maybe that's wrong. Maybe there's lots of charities out there to do so. But like I said, I'm willing to go ahead and vote on this piece of legislation. I'm just, like I said, my concerns are for the underlying piece of bill with the other bill that languished in rules for the entire year. And I understand this is different. I said it was very similar. It's not the exact same piece of legislation before us, but that was my concern. Senator Giesel, any closing remarks?
Mr. Chairman, the avoided cost is something that needs to be considered much more than perhaps the immediate cost. The avoided cost of a suicide, the avoided cost of a drug-addicted emerging adult, we know this is prevalent, the cost of incarceration. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I'll maintain my objection. We'll take a roll call vote.
Senator Giesel.
Yes.
Senator Dunbar.
Yes.
Senator Tobin.
Yes.
Senator Kaufman.
No.
Senator Wilson.
No.
Three yeas, two nays.
With 3 yeas and 2 yeas, amendment number 1 passes. Senator, I'm sorry, does the department have any other closing comments or remarks you'd like to make on this piece of legislation as amended?
To the chair, Senator Wilson, we'd just like to thank you for considering SB 240.
All right. Thank you so much. Is there a date and time that you guys may have a analysis complete on the bill as amended?
To the chair, we can certainly follow up with you on a date that we can respond by.
All right. Well, with that, I will set this bill aside until we wait for the department to give us back an analysis of the bill. With that, we are going to be adjourned here at 5:03. Is there any closing comments? Seeing none, we are adjourned.